Astonishing Legends Network.
Disclaimer. This episode includes the usual amount of adult language and graphic discussions you've come to expect around here. But in the event it becomes an unusual amount, expect another call from me.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Scare It All The Time. I'm Chris Kalari.
And I'm Ed Vicola.
And this week we are digging into the past to unearth something ancient, sacred, and very, very fucked up. With the new Mummy movie hitting theaters tomorrow, we thought we'd break out the bandages and crawl from the tomb to talk about the wild history and persistent mystery of all things wrapped and bandaged and mummified.
Okay.
Before you tune out because you think you know everything about mummies from watching Boris Karloff stumble around a backlot or Brendan Fraser punching sand, trust me, you don't. Because it turns out curses are far from the weirdest, scariest things about mummies. From the gory details of how they were created to the unspeakable things we've done to their remains over the centuries, story of the desiccated dead is a bizarre and twisted tale on par with any horror movie. So join us as we crack open the sarcophagus this week. Don't breathe into dust. And please, for the love of God, do not take any souvenirs. This podcast is cursed enough as it is.
Shit, man.
What are we?
Scared.
When are we?
All the time.
Join us.
Now it is time for...
Scared All The Time.
All right, so longtime listeners of this show might be thinking, haven't you guys already talked about mummies? And you would be correct. I guess you actually haven't. You wouldn't have to have been listening that long to have heard us talking about mummies in our curses episode. And we also touched a little bit on mummification in the Buried Alive episode. Two-parter Buried Alive? Yeah, two-part
Buried
Alive.
There was two parts. I don't remember which part.
If you haven't checked those out, go do that. I think they'll nicely complement this episode. But today is mummies the main event. Because unless you are some sort of a professional mummy doctor, studier, scientist... Ed, are you looking for a mummy?
Sorry, I just had to move something. My mummy collection. My stolen artifacts display case.
Unless you are a professional mummy head, a mummy studier, I'm going to bet that almost everything that you think you know about them is either wrong, incomplete, or nowhere near as disturbing as the actual truth about them. But before we dive into all of that, Ed, I got to know, what is your relationship with mummies? Were you scared of them ever? Were you ever a mummy for Halloween?
What's interesting is I've never been a mummy, but it's an easy costume.
Yeah.
I've never been a mummy for Halloween. My relationship is I'm a person of a certain age, so there was never a mummy movie that wasn't just the most fun.
Yeah.
So like we're Brendan Fraser mummy people, I would imagine.
Yep.
And I don't consider that movie scary in the slightest. I don't find the mummy to be a genuine threat. I think he's doing something that might end the world. I don't know. But that movie, it's like, it's in the way that I don't find a lot of Indiana Jones scary, even knowing like the second one's got a lot of scary stuff.
Yeah.
It's just like I'm having so much fun watching it. I associate the word mummy with having a good time, actually.
Okay. All right. Well, this episode's going to be a good time. I would say in the Brendan Fraser mummy movies, there's one scene where a guy gets eaten by scarabs that found kind of scary when I was younger.
I feel that exact same way about the Boo Box and Hook.
Yes.
So get these bugs off of us, man.
Yeah. Look, mummies are a tough sell as scary horror villains, I think. They shamble, they moan, they do a lot of strangling. They're basically a zombie that's one zombie and doesn't eat brains.
Well, that's why I think the mummy did a good job of being like, what if it's kind of like a hot guy? Like a bald, like not Billy Zane.
Well, we'll see what this mummy movie is like that comes out tomorrow.
I already saw the trailer had way too much mummy in it.
Lee Cronin's The Mummy. It seems like they're trying to go for a scary thing, but it does seem like there's not actually like a shambling mummy. It's this more possessed dead kid angle.
No, I think Suicide Squad had a little mummy ask shit in it too, where they just got a babe.
Yeah.
So I think you gotta throw like a handsome or hot, you gotta throw a hot person in there and get rid of those wraps immediately.
Well, right, but then what that does, I think, and what you see in most of the attempts Universal has made to relaunch The Mummy as a franchise is both the addition of the hot person and the fact that they always feel like they have to give the mummy some kind of powers to make up for the fact that it's dead turns it more into...
Yeah, like, why isn't it just a voodoo movie at that point?
It's just more of a fantasy horror adventure at that point, no matter how you square it.
Necromancer.
You're not really getting that kind of groaning, shambling kind of mummy that I think is one of the first things that comes to mind when people think of mummies.
Well, I mean, it's in their defense of making it that way.
Yeah.
Don't they have like their brains taken out through their nose?
Oh.
They're not working with brains. Of course they'd be like slow.
We will get to exactly, we will get into detail about what comes out of mummies and how.
Yeah, and they go into little jars and stuff. We'll get into that, I'm sure. And I feel like that's the stuff they toss to the side in the movies.
They're yes.
just like, well, because I mean, think about it. This guy's, he's thinking with sand. To quote, what was that movie? What was that movie with Bruce Campbell where he's in like a retirement home? He's like Elvis.
Oh, Bubba Hotep. Yeah, like, there's that, kind of a mummy vampire thing coming after them.
But to quote that movie, I'm thinking with sand here.
Yeah.
The guy's got like sand for a brain or whatever.
My favorite, I'll say, I don't know if you have a favorite classic mummy design. I mean, my first encounter with the classic mummy design were those orange Crestwood horror books. They were hardcover, bright orange, and they were like, they were 1930s horror movies repackaged as sort of books for second or third grade readers with black and white photos from the movies, and the stories were simplified. And that was the first place I came across the classic Karloff mummy.
And he was slow moving, wrapped in stuff.
Wrapped in stuff.
I think, I guess I can't pinpoint mummies. I mean, so much of, you know, Monster Squad and stuff where they're like making fun of the Universal monsters would be some of my earliest.
Yes, but I was just going to say, the Monster Squad mummy, actually all of the Monster Squad monsters, I think are incredible modern-ish version of those creatures. Not in the sense that they are necessarily the most frightening, but Stan Winston designed all of them, and they managed to capture everything we love about the Universal version of those monsters, but give them sort of a fresh coat of paint. And the mummy in particular, even though it's not particularly threatening in the movie, I love the visual design of the mummy in that movie. It's angular, it's dirtier.
Yeah.
It's like, there's just something cool about the mummy in that movie, about all the monsters in that
movie. But I
guess
the mummy to me, just in the context of Universal monsters.
Yeah.
Even at the time they were made, which was an amazingly a time where they were like, these are scary movies. Even at the time they were made, doing press or whatever, I feel like there probably was like, and the mummy. You know what I mean? It's
we got
fucking Bela Lugosi's vampire. We've got a werewolf. And there's a mummy.
Yeah,
we also have this mummy.
Invisible
Man? Maybe the better wrapped guy movie. But we have the mummy as well.
I think we mentioned this in the Curses episode that, you know, the mummy movie itself wasn't made that long after Egypt mania of like the curses of opening the tomb. And so like a lot of that, I think, was kind of coasting on almost like recent news. You know, it was like semi-recent.
And it's a great concept of like pillaging in the sense that like a bunch of British dudes in stupid hats show up and they're like, oh, this is tight. I'm going to take this.
Yeah.
And it would just be, I mean, the fucking Museum of Natural History in like every major city has some shit from Egypt in it.
Yeah.
And so there is a good thing. If something is cursed, it's a great idea.
Yeah.
Especially at the time they were making those movies where it was like not long after like the New York Museum is introducing
mummies.
This mummy thing. So they would be like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if something followed you home?
Actually, now that I think about it, though, I guess maybe we would not necessarily have the idea of the modern Romero zombie without the Karloff mummy, because the modern Romero zombies, like zombies have existed in culture, but they were always more of like a Haitian voodoo. Like the real zombie was that sort of the Serpent in the Rainbow style zombie. Ooh,
that's why I said earlier, like what if you, without the wrappings, these things are just voodoo stories or necromancer stories.
Right, but I sort of wonder, I mean, it's too late to ask him now because he is a member of the undead, but I wonder if George Romero was influenced at all by
probably
the shambling mummy figure and just sort of turned it up to 11 to create modern
probably
zombies.
I've seen that original movie. They couldn't afford the wrappings.
No.
It probably was originally a mummy movie, and he was like, we don't got enough toilet paper.
Yeah.
Like the crew isn't already using. Let's just make them a guy in a suit.
Yeah, and I also think, I would also say the reason mummies probably fall to the bottom of most people's monster fears is that my theory, and this is different for everybody, but generally I feel like the most effective horror is more like if you can imagine something scary happening to you, if it feels like it's something that could happen when you go outside, that's the most effective horror. And the only way that you're really coming across a mummy is a pretty specific, like, you either have to be a grave robber or running a museum or something to really encounter a mummy on a regular basis.
Yeah, I love Indiana Jones is always like, this belongs in a museum.
Yeah.
And the museum's like, will you stop giving us these? It's been a nightmare for us.
Yeah.
Just leave them where they are, Indy.
So I'm not particularly concerned about waking up to find a mummy standing at the foot of my bed, but the lore and the science and the myth around them is so gross and gory and dusty and in touch with the world of the dead that this might actually end up being one of my favorite episodes.
Well, the thing I'm most looking forward to in this episode, and if it exists, I'm pumped. And if it doesn't, less pumped.
I'm fired.
Yeah, you're fired. Is I really want there to be an insane number of booby traps where they're buried.
Oh boy. You might be disappointed.
You might be unemployed.
there's really the creation of the chambers that a lot of mummies were buried in. Let's just say that there's a disappointing amount of traps. Booby traps were not something that ancient peoples were particularly invested in making last very long, if there ever were booby traps.
Okay.
Nature set some booby traps by, I don't get into it in the episode, but there is some research around, and I think this is what we talk about in Curses. So if you haven't and you want a deeper dive on this, go listen to Curses. But the idea that perhaps there was some kind of like bacteria or viruses or whatever that had been kind of sealed up in some of these pots and chambers, and that when people broke open those doors to go in there, they may have been exposed to like mold or whatever that made them sick. But I don't think any of that was set there on purpose. It was just sort of nature doing its thing.
Yeah. Your air being like, you're telling me there's no way out?
Air being,
there's no way out.
Yeah.
Well, we're toxic now.
So to start, let's nail down exactly what a mummy is, because the same images that caught my attention as a kid are so baked into the cultural idea of a mummy that you'd be forgiven for thinking that mummies are A, exclusively Egyptian, and B, only count as such when wrapped in thin strips of fabric. But that is just one example of the form. We turn to Wikipedia, which tells us, a mummy is a dead human or animal whose soft tissues and organs have been preserved by either intentional or accidental exposure to chemicals, extreme cold, very low humidity, or lack of air, so that the recovered body does not decay further if kept in cool and dry conditions.
So a mummy is not a noun then? Because if it's unintentional as well, someone's been mummified.
Well, you can find a mummy. There's many, many animal mummies throughout the world, particularly
like that one that with the Cheetos one from our Patreon
from our live show. Yeah.
Yeah,
that just like fell into a cave and then like became desiccated and dried out, and we found it 8,000 years later,
and then
it
we put a zoot
skin.
Suit on it.
Yeah, and then just degraded it live.
If you want to hear that,
mummies of humans and animals have been found on every continent, both as a result of natural preservation and as cultural artifacts. We'll get into this a little bit more later, but over 1 million animal mummies have been found in Egypt, many of which are cats. Evidence of deliberate mummification in human cultures is documented to have existed across Southeast Asia, China, New Guinea, and Australia, where discoveries made just last year in 2025 tell us that various cultures have been practicing mummification since approximately 10,000 BC. These new finds are prompting research into cultures documented to 20,000 years ago for evidence of use of the same mummification methods. So this means that the oldest deliberately mummified humans are somewhere around 8,000 years older than Egyptian mummies and 6,000 to 7,000 years older than the wheel.
Oh, wow. So they had to carry all of these mummies yeah, around just two guys.
It's funny.
For each mummy.
We'll get into that in a minute. But I just think it really puts our perspective to turn human beings into jerky, or it really puts our desire to turn human beings into jerky into perspective, that we were doing this thousands of years before we figured out how to move them.
And if climate change has its way, we might be doing it for sustenance soon.
Yeah, so. Yes. So I know we sometimes go in historical order on this show, but I think for this episode, the best place to start our journey through the dead is with a closer look at the Egyptian mummy, because it's what most people think of first,
yeah.
And we know a lot about them.
And we're getting to that thing now where everything's being memed as like, you know, we're now as far away from whatever as
yes.
the Egyptians were from whatever.
Yeah.
And I never remember... obviously, the fill in the blanks on that, but
yeah.
I see the pyramids come up a lot.
Well, it's
these days.
The big one for me is we live closer to the era of Tyrannosaurus Rex than Tyrannosaurus Rex lived to, I believe, Stegosaurus.
How the fuck is that helping anybody?
Oh, it's not, but it's just wild. To, that's how much time passed.
But I can't figure that out. I don't understand the reference I'm saying. Like, I can look and see the pyramids, and I get that.
Yeah.
And I know that humans made them.
Yeah.
Okay, there goes half our audience. or aliens, whatever.
Yeah. Whoever you want to have made them,
they
really.
They made it.
We have no evidence.
But it is... Yeah, that I can track, but I can't imagine. As far as I'm concerned, Stegosaurus and T-Rexes are hanging out together.
Right, but they weren't. There was it's like 65 million years between us and T-Rex, and I think like 100 million years between T-Rex and Stegosaurus.
So they're never together?
No.
Only in the movies?
Only in the movies. Like
we're going to say that a lot about mummies today, too.
Yeah, the Jurassic, the earliest parts of the Jurassic period and the latest parts of the Cretaceous period, I don't remember the actual time scale, but it's immense amounts of time. And then if you go back to the Triassic period, forget about it. That's like,
do you think people who know this type of stuff, when they saw Jurassic Park, were like, you crazy for this one?
Yeah,
that's fucking together. I never thought I'd see it.
Well, Jurassic Park wouldn't work for a lot of reasons, but yes, part of the reason it wouldn't work is because you're not only putting dinosaurs and humans together, you're putting dinosaurs together that had never experienced.
Oh, that's like I can't even imagine. I'm trying to think of like a zoo where it's like a zoos must be nuts for animals.
Yeah.
But like a giraffe hanging out with something is like, what the fuck are you?
Yeah.
Like T-Rex would be like, what are you?
Yeah.
To a Stegosaurus.
Yeah, exactly. So.
Well, I'm Steg.
Stegly. We don't have to worry about it. I mean, you could also argue that dinosaurs in a Jurassic Park wouldn't really be dinosaurs. They would be some sort of modern Frankenstein hybridization of the closest thing we could get.
So what you're saying is that T-Rex would be like, what even are you? And then Stegosaurus would say, what are we?
Yeah, T-Rex would say, what even am I?
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, one of the most important things to understand about mummies is that the Egyptians weren't mummifying the dead for fun or to preserve information about their culture even. Funerary rituals changed over time, but mummification in the Egyptian culture was considered an essential component if you were to have a successful afterlife.
According, but only for like rich people, like pharaohs and shit, or were regular ass people getting...
For everybody.
Okay.
So according,
I bet you some of these mummifications look real shitty.
They do.
Like what are the Turkish hair transplants of? After we learned about that yesterday. In real time.
According to the Spurlock Museum at the University of Illinois, quote, two very important things were necessary for a person to go to one's Akh, or become a blessed one who could spend a pleasant eternal life. One component to that was passing a final judgment. The other component was having a well-preserved body that person's soul could recognize and return to after something called the opening of the mouth ceremony.
Okay. Better name would be better.
I mean, it's pretty straightforward what happens during that ceremony. I believe the mouth is opened and the soul returns
sure.
to the body.
Interesting that the mouth is, but like everything else is through the nose.
Although some stuff is through all kinds of different holes. We'll hold that thought.
Hold that thought. Yeah.
The two most important divisions of the soul were the ka and the ba.
Okay.
The ka was the person's double, and it stayed with the deceased in the tomb. The ba was portrayed as a human-headed bird that could leave the tomb during the day but needed to return to their body at night, sort of like Jeffrey Epstein when he was put in prison for his first crime.
He was allowed to leave
during the day. You could think of a ba as sort of a Jeffrey Epstein type.
With wings. Yeah.
Without the mummified human, the ba and the ka could not survive. So the body, the mummified body, was like the anchor for both parts of your soul.
Is the body the ba? And
no.
I'm not doing that for body.
No,
I'm saying, because it's like a double, you said.
There were two parts of your spirit. So the ka stayed with the body and the ba could go out and come back.
These are both spirit-based. Got you.
So to assure your continued existence in the afterlife, the Egyptians worked hard to find the perfect method of preserving the body. Interestingly, the Global Egyptian Museum tells us that our knowledge of the mummification process does not come from the ancient Egyptians themselves, and the City Museum elaborates that, quote, ancient Egyptian sources on the treatment of the human body after death are scarce, with only a few inscriptions and funerary images. The few texts that have survived, such as the ritual of embalming, focus on the rituals, and the more practical and gruesome aspects of mummification are largely ignored.
You know, I never thought about this in my entire life until right this second.
Yep.
Hieroglyphs.
Yep.
It is a language
that's
picture-based.
Yes.
where are the better drawings? Like, literally, an image is worth 1,000 words, but they're like, what if it's just one word?
Yeah.
And so why do we not have a wood etching of these events from ancient Egypt versus like, well, I told them about it. You can see from the bird head, guy doing the Egyptian dance.
Yeah, you know lots I mean? Of guys doing the Egyptian dance.
Yeah, so you have to like kind of glean from that what you will.
There's a lot of speculation about this. Some people think that the rituals were considered so sacred that they were never passed down anywhere. That they were never written down anywhere. They were only passed down through an oral tradition.
Okay.
Some people think that perhaps, you know, they were written, if there were ever written instructions for any of this, that perhaps it was written on papyrus that didn't survive very long and was never painted onto a wall or something, never hieroglyphed into a tomb, because once you're in the tomb, you wouldn't necessarily need the rules for how to make a mummy on the wall.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, look, I hung for the longest time the ratios for how to make a good cup of coffee over my coffee machine.
Yeah, okay.
So, like, maybe you would do that for a mummy.
Yeah,
in
I have
the tomb,
a thing
but...
on my refrigerator right now that's like the breakdown of like 2 teaspoons is one
yeah.
quart, whatever. You know what I mean? Like,
but they had, as we'll get into in a moment here, they had a lot of guys who were very good at all the different aspects of this. So,
yeah.
They didn't. This was the kind of thing where generations of people existed to do one part of the ritual.
Yeah.
You know? So, you didn't necessarily need to write any of this down.
Yeah, and it's a good job to have. Everyone's getting it done.
Great job
to have. Like, yeah. And no one can kill you because no one else knows how to do it.
Yeah. Well, great job for some people, but
oh, I'm sure there were some sons and daughters who were like, I feel like I want to dance. I don't want to cut brains out anymore, or even to begin with.
But in any case, this is where the ancient Greeks come in, as they usually do around this point in the show.
Yeah. Is that Rosetta Stone included Egyptian hieroglyphs, didn't it?
Well, no.
I take it back. Don't ever listen.
I don't know if the Rosetta Stone included Egyptian hieroglyphs, but the Greeks are coming in at this part of the show because we actually know more about the mummification process in Egypt due to the writing of the Greeks than the writing of the Egyptians.
Well, yeah, that's why I brought up the Rosetta Stone, because that was shit where they were out here just transcribing stuff in 3 languages, the same sign.
Right.
And so sometimes it takes another culture to come up and be like, hey, this way to Denny's on the sign is written for everyone who lives there.
Right.
And you're not going to get that if it's all just hieroglyphs, if it's all just Latin.
Right.
So, yeah, I guess Greeks are pretty cool because they wrote things down.
Well, not only did they...
And preserved it.
They did write it down and preserve it. The problem that we will face here in a moment is that...
The financial collapse they faced a few years ago. Well, do they have money anymore? I don't know.
The Greeks?
Yeah. Remember that? It was like the country went bankrupt or something?
I think they have money, but they don't have jobs, I think is sort of...
Okay. We're hurtling towards that. We should start writing everything down in triplicate, too.
No, the issue is that the writing we have isn't contemporary with mummification processes. So, like, we don't have the firsthand witnesses to a lot of it, but we have what was recorded as having been passed down. So thanks to the writing of Herodotus, Diodorus Siculus, and fragments of Plutarch's writing, we do know...
We're going to a convention this weekend. We're hoping people are wearing Diodotitlis, sort of like you just said.
Ed's making a stinky comic fan joke. We'll see you at WonderCon, folks.
Yeah, this will come out after that. But...
That's true. But thanks to the writing of those three, we do know a lot of the process, and we have also been able to confirm a lot of what they wrote by mummifying things with the processes that they wrote about in the present. So
if only the Greeks were there for those fucking homunculi stuff, we could have had better homunculi records.
We could have. We might actually have homunculi in the studio with us.
Oh, hell yeah. At the homunculi level of Patreon, you can get your own one sent to you. It will dial on the way.
It will be made from equal parts my shit and Ed's cum.
Yep.
It's going to be an incredible little man.
Yeah, but we're going to write for the postal service that it's a book. I guess the Greeks would have to go home and try it a few times just because there could be, you know, I've seen enough movies about journalists where it's like, don't tell them, or even my mom giving out recipes.
Yeah.
She doesn't want it to be, if it's like a family recipe, she might leave like one really important thing out
right.
so that people can't replicate as good of granola.
But hang on a second. And journalists leave important things out. Why?
No, I meant people who are like talking to a journalist.
As
who
a
might,
source.
Might leave out something that would reveal.
I see.
And so I guess they would have to go back and test it. Could be like, I don't know, fucking whomever told me in Egypt this is how you do it, but he could have had over his shoulder like, we never revealed to the men from over the horizon the like white guy that came. We're not going to tell him exactly how this ancient procedure goes.
I see.
Like, leave out the part about how they get powers.
I think they did leave out the part about how they get powers, because nothing that was written down has anything to do with infusing a mummy with magical powers. But we do know that the earliest detailed account of Egyptian mummification comes from Herodotus, writing around 450 BC. And I don't want to get too sidetracked by Herodotus, but he is a super interesting figure. Based on how much he traveled and the quality of his writing, they think, and by they I mean archaeologists and people who study the classics and stuff, think that he seems to have been very wealthy and educated, but no one has any idea where his money came from.
Sick.
Which, if you had a ton of money in 450 BC, people know, but you didn't get it anywhere good.
Yeah. But also, I think about this, even Indiana Jones is probably going to come up a lot in this episode, but yeah. I think about this, and even in Indiana Jones, where it's like the 30s.
Yeah.
And it was like, he took a Zeppelin there? Like, these red lines on the screen across the map are not taking into account that was weeks.
Yeah.
Like, so the fact that this guy's doing it even before that, he's on some weird trade ship, like, in 330 BC to get to a place that, like, someone assured him was there.
Yeah.
Like, he's never been to fucking... Well, no, because even Julius Caesar and shit would be years later that they would ever go to hang out with Cleopatra, I'm saying. So this guy is really taking a chance that there is an Egypt, that there are things of interest there, and then also being rich, you're just carrying a bunch of gold or silver, hay, or whatever the currency
you didn't have checks back then.
So it's like, fuck, man, you had to show up with like, I hope this is enough gold to
not get killed,
the palms, but also not so much that I'm instantly killed.
True. It's a very fine line amount of gold that you need to have on you at all times.
Yes. Which also makes me think togas must have just been for the Senate. Like, this guy had to have a backpack, maybe some closed-toed shoes. Like,
probably.
He's going to be trekking in the sun.
Well,
God, we're going to... Let us know if you want us to do a full episode on Ed learns about...
the ancient Greeks.
Very specific things that have nothing to do with the show that have interested me.
Herodotus's most famous piece of writing is a book called The Histories, and it garnered him two memorable nicknames.
And two Peabody Awards.
The Father of History and the Father of Lies.
Ooh.
The book opens with a hell of a line. Herodotus of Halicarnassus here displays his inquiry, so that human achievements may not become forgotten in time, and great and marvelous deeds, some displayed by Greeks, some by barbarians, may not be without their glory. According to modern scholars, quote, what cements Herodotus as the father of history were his attempts to explain the course of human events through causal consequences. This blew my mind because I'd never thought about this before. But he basically was on the tip of like, this set of decisions by people led to a certain action, which brought on another reaction and so on. Before that, the idea of the past and history was literally just who, what, when, why, where.
Who's writing right now, usually will suffice. You don't have to.
Well, not
but
the.
But so far, we don't ever. Usually, we don't get those from writing anymore.
Not the why, the who, the what, and the when.
I guess he introduced the
he
why.
He introduced the why.
Sure, okay.
Why did the Persians hate the Greeks so much? Why did mighty Egypt, the crown jewel of antiquity, fall to the Persians? Why did one powerful leader after another fall victim to pride, revenge, or greed? So they say that Herodotus invented history as we know it because he was the first to see these myriad stories from the past as small parts of a bigger story, the story of the known human world.
Got you.
Now, the problem is that the best historical data he could get his hands on were called logoi, the stories told by people who either witnessed an event firsthand or had received knowledge passed down through strong oral traditions. And the logoi weren't always the most reliable.
Oh, no.
Herodotus wrote of winged serpents in Arabia, giant gold-digging ants, and made claims about battles where almost everyone involved died. So there's a big question about who was left to describe what happened in the battle to him.
But I will say, to his point, to the first guy to bring the why into the equation, how often do Indiana Jones or anything else... where you see it was like, oh, this hieroglyph says, like, this is based on the Sanskrit word for whatever, because they believed that the earth was made by God had two piles of sand, and then he did this. So the why, the cause and effect, were mythology,
yes,
mythos, including, by the way, very famously from the Greeks.
Yeah, yeah.
So he might have been the first guy who was like, maybe it wasn't a centaur.
Yeah.
Let me go see. And then he, unfortunately for him, and he had to write it down because he's good at his job, he was like, a lot of places think it's a centaur. Like
yeah,
a right. lot of places, they have different words for it.
Yeah.
But a lot of places have the same shit we've got because no one was around to be like, oh, this guy wanted power.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So he did dig up a lot of truths, but he was a storyteller at heart, and you know, he could only check some of this information, sort of like this podcast.
Yeah.
He could only do so much fact checking, and he went, hey, you know what? This sounds pretty good. We're going to go with this.
We do more than most. So
we have to keep all that in mind, because his account of Egyptian burial traditions starts, plainly enough, with descriptions of grief. He tells us that after a loved one passed, women of the household covered themselves in mud and walked through town beating their bare breasts.
Okay.
But then comes the part about necrophilia. According to Herodotus, if the deceased was a beautiful or distinguished woman, the family deliberately held the body in the home for 3 to 4 days
before
sending it to the embalmers, because they wanted to make sure the body was gross and stinky and rotten enough that if there were a lecherous embalmer involved in the process,
which is all of them,
which was probably many of them, he would not try to shit where he eats, so
I'm
to speak.
I'm going to tell you right now, you're not allowed to make rules in this here United States about, like, there's like a, you can't just say, hey, I'm not going to hire Chris because he's a fucking disgusting Italian.
Yeah.
Can't do that here.
Correct.
These days.
Right.
I think we should be able to make a rule that, like, you can't work in a morgue if you're a guy.
Like,
you know what I mean? They're just, I'm not saying anything's going to happen, but I would say that Haramalabalus or whatever here is going to be like, and on my 30th interview.
Herodotus and chronicler of modern history, Quentin Tarantino, both show us what happens to a body left out in the morgue.
I think if it was put up to a vote to society, I think people would be like, yes, is it against the freedoms of the people in this? It is, but you know what? We're all on board.
Yeah.
Just ladies work here.
So,
and also women, fucking Jesus, that horrible lives, and probably still, definitely still, but I'm saying, like, every one of the stories we do that go back earlier than like 1979,
like,
it was like, boo, that's rough.
The only way to keep the women from being assaulted was
to hide them.
Yeah. So, to be fair, no one else has ever made this claim about the bodies being kept at home to rot
them.
He's
the only real one, dude.
Well,
he's the only one who will tell you what's up.
Herodotus is the only one.
He's a gonzo journalist.
He is. So it has to be taken with a grain of salt. It may be one of the lies that he fathered. But we luckily also have the writings of Diodorus Siculus, who is generally considered a bit more reliable, although still relying on a lot of the same skills that Herodotus used.
Yeah, he just wanted to be able to put it on TikTok. He's over here writing segs in Unalived, where our boy Haraki, I'm never going to remember these names.
Herodotus.
Like, he's just like, he doesn't give a fuck, dude.
Yeah. Well, Diodorus Siculus tells us that the corpse, once they had it, would be sent to what the Egyptians called the Per-Nefer, which translates to House of Beauty, which I think is really just a fancy and sort of optimistic name for the embalmers.
Okay.
Just like a modern day burial or the Scared All the Time Patreon, the family would be presented with 3 options from most expensive to least expensive.
Sure.
And we'll get to the differences in a moment. But after the family chose their tier, the chief embalmer would get to work. This guy was known as the Hare Seshta, or Master of Secrets, and he wore a jackal mask to represent Anubis, the god of the dead.
Do you think one of the secrets he carries is what he does for a living? I'd be at parties being like, oh, I'm just stay-at-home dad.
Sort of, because the Hare Seshta oversaw a team of specialists, all of whom, despite being priests with sacred anatomical knowledge, were also considered ritually unclean and had to live in a segregated necropolis away from the living.
Yeah, that's one too many dinner party was ruined by these people, is what that says.
They're like, look, you guys, you live over here
now. You can't talk about work with anyone else but each other. But I do find it interesting, the anatomical secrets, because, you know, even in fictional fantasy, you'd have like, Game of Thrones would have these like maesters or whatever, where it's like, I'm gonna have a baby, go find a maester. Like, no one else was taught that.
Yeah,
only like religious or very wealthy people had any knowledge of.
Yeah,
I mean, even some of our heroes from these episodes where like ladies had eight teeth or more teeth or whatever it was. Like people straight up, like if you weren't in that very specific club, you're just guessing.
Yeah. And so these guys knew a lot, but knew a little too much to be let out in public. So anyway, if you were, if your family chose the most expensive mummification method, as many of the mummies that we have were,
that we still have, yeah, the ones that were made with care.
The first step was to remove the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, many of you who have seen anything mummy related, or Ed, as you suggested earlier, this had to, this was done through the nose.
Yeah.
A long hooked iron instrument was inserted through your nostrils, but that was not to pull the brain out. That was to break the ethmoid bone, which is the thin plate of bone between your nose and your brain. That when people are like, oh, if you give them a palm strike,
you
break the ethmoid bone.
Well, no one ever said the second part. That's why I never heard of
it. It goes into their brain. That's the, if you palm strike someone's nose, the idea is you shatter the bone into their brain.
But then cocaine can get around it without issue?
I get, well, not without issue, depending on how much cocaine you do. But you had to break the bone first, and then this hook was used to liquefy the brain matter, but then the brain matter was not pulled out on a hook.
How does it liquefy? Do they make it hot?
Oh, buddy, you just stirred it up. You stir it up, and then you drained the brain out through the nose by gravity.
And I hate this.
We know that this works because in 1994, celebrated...
The release of Nevermind or something.
the celebrated Egyptologist and philosophy professor Bob Breyer, or Mr. Mummy, according to the article I found, was so stumped by certain aspects of ancient mummification that he and a research partner named Robert Wade decided to create a mummy themselves using only ancient techniques and materials.
This should have been...
And hopefully not a member of their family.
Yeah, man. This is, again, this is something where it's like by two people who decided to remain anonymous. Like, why would you throw your name on this disgusting thing?
The opposite of anonymous.
I guess
they're famous for this.
Yeah, but I guess it has to get done.
Because like you said, it took a lot of trial and error. And after a lot of trial and error with, I assume, maybe bodies that were donated to science.
No, it has to. Like, and you know what? Thank God for these two guys to do it, not to prisoners of war.
Yeah.
Like, this is just like everyone's on board. Yes, it's good if everyone's on board.
Yeah. They confirmed after much trial and error that the brain was not pulled out in chunks, as you would think in these movies. It was liquefied into brain stew and then poured out of the head through the nose. And
but
then
the head's still attached to the head, but the body at this point?
Yes.
Okay.
And then all that brain matter was just thrown away. Because to the Egyptians, they considered the brain useless. To them, it was the origin of mucus. That's what they thought the brain was for, that it created the mucus in your body. The heart.
It's just a bunch of little Mucinex guys coming out of your nose. He's all shitty and like has like an accent. Like,
they believed that the heart was where intelligence lived.
Honestly, it does for me too.
It's just a sweet thought.
Yeah, four chambers. They loved chambers. The heart has chambers.
The heart has chambers. What episode was it where we learned that there was somebody else that thought the heart was where... That the heart was for warming your blood or something?
I don't remember anymore. I'm sure it was one of our heroes. But it's...
Yeah. People have had all kinds of weird thoughts about the brain, the heart, the stomach, the lungs. They had no idea until like 20 years ago.
That we're all just like everything. We're just a brain in a mech suit.
Yeah.
Is the reality of the situation. But yeah, I think we should... I don't think it's going to work for a button of the month, but I do think we should build some sort of like ever-evolving Mount Rushmore of like... nonsense heroes from the show.
Yeah,
ladies have different amount of teeth.
Yeah,
like people who show up a bunch, like Hieronymus or help. Now he's a Hieronymus Bosch is an artist.
Yeah,
but I'm saying like that can be fun.
Yeah, it would be
just
a good
to remember
idea.
The things we once did.
Yeah. I like this. Once the brain was juiced and dumped into the street, a scribe marked the left side.
Oh my god!
A scribe marked the left side of the corpse's abdomen. Then a man again with very fine-tuned, completely useless in every other aspect of life knowledge. This man called the Parastakes, a man called the Parastakes, or the Slitter,
oh my God,
stepped forward with an obsidian blade and made the incision down the abdomen.
Obsidian's a cool rock.
And then, according to Diodorus Siculus, the Slitter immediately had to turn and run while his colleagues pelted him with stones and cursed him, because cutting a body was desecration, even when necessary. So the Slitter was like a sin eater. He was like a ritual scapegoat.
I was literally going to compare it to a sin eater.
He did the dirty work and took the spiritual hit and was pelted with stones. So
the physical hit too, it sounded like.
So no one else had to.
They're dump brain juice on
What a shit job.
It's a shit job. This is like, Egypt also invent beer?
They had.
I think they invented beer.
They had ales or something.
Which I think is specifically for guys with this job. It's like, I got to go to the bar. How was your day? How do you think? I'm a fucking Slitter.
Just
give me another round, please. Yeah.
After the Slitter fled and got drunk at the bar, an embalmer reached into the incision that he made and pulled out everything except the kidneys and the heart.
Yeah, now that creep's gone, let me do this.
let me dig into the corpse. This is fine.
What we do is fine. What he did was heinous.
The removed organs were washed in palm wine, packed with spices, mm-hmm. and placed into four jars.
Yeah, I mentioned the jars.
Each jar guarded by one of the four sons of Horus. There was Imseti, who had a human head and got the liver, Api, the baboon-headed one, who got the lungs, Duamutef, the jackal, who got the stomach, and Kebes Senuf, the falcon, who got the intestines.
Okay, must be the biggest jar.
right? There's like three small jars and one gigantic
jar.
Wine barrel size. The body was then packed inside and out with roughly 580 pounds of natron, a naturally occurring salt, and left for 40 days to dry out.
500
and
pounds.
80 pounds. Yeah, almost 600 pounds.
I mean, how is that not shoving, 20 pounds of shit in a 5-pound bag or whatever? Like, that's...
Well, I think it was packed inside and out. So
maybe
inside
it's also incredibly dense and heavy. Maybe it's like a little bit of spent uranium goes a long way.
Yeah,
in my brain, it's like, how do they fit that much in one? But maybe they're heavy.
I think a bunch of it was put in and then they were probably packed around the body with the rest of it.
Oh.
So they probably put like 40 pounds or whatever inside the body.
I thought this was fully turkey stuffing.
No. Okay. After the body was left for 40 days to dry out, the cavity was stuffed with linen, sawdust, and sometimes onions, which that tells you how bad the body still smelled. That they're like, let's put the onions and garlic in here.
Yeah.
The skin was coated with ox fat and cedar oil, and then cinnamon, myrrh, and frankincense.
Dude, honestly, I want to eat these fucking things. But everything you've described so far, from like the spices and the heart or whatever, and then like all, I use like half these ingredients.
Not in cookies.
Maybe molasses.
After the body was packed with cinnamon, myrrh, and frankincense, each finger and each toe was individually wrapped in linen before the entire body was cocooned in hundreds of yards of linen strips. The most elaborate mummies used approximately 4,000 square feet of linen to wrap the whole body.
Plentiful? Whatever linen's made from?
They made a lot of linens in Egypt.
I guess. Looms? Do they have looms at that point?
I don't know. I wish I could tell you, but I don't know. Protective amulets were then placed between, well, I guess not then, but as the body was being wrapped in linens, protective amulets were placed between the layers.
So it's like making great nachos.
Basically, there was a wejat eye to protect against evil, a heart scarab to keep things light for judgment in the afterlife, and a headrest amulet to prevent decapitation in the next world. So, to your point, you would think the smell would be horrendous, but a groundbreaking 2025 study in the Journal of American Chemical Society analyzed 9 mummies in Cairo and found that the dominant aromas of a mummy were woody, spicy, and sweet, thanks to pine, cedar, and juniper resins mixed with myrrh and frankincense.
Yeah, I'm sure a guy pretty early on in this process was like, there's got to be a better way. And you know what? Now they need potpourri to get to the other side. You know what I mean? Just adding shit to not make it the most heinous job.
Yeah.
It's already hot in the desert.
I still don't know about the onions, but hey, you know what? Everything else sounds pretty good. So conservators have described the scent of a mummy as surprisingly pleasant. And it turns out the Egyptians actually equated a good smell with spiritual purity. So they were into, let's make this shit smell good, because otherwise your soul's dirty.
Also, like, the Yankee Candle factory there has like mummy smells.
You I was gonna get, say
like,
that might
candle
that might be a good merch item for us.
I do make my own candles. I haven't in a while. I don't know if I'll be doing that soon, because I've never got good at not having the wick just be like black smoke all the time.
Right. So, like I said, all of this was the deluxe package.
Yeah.
The $25 Patreon, if you will. The mid-range tier skipped the incision and the organ removal, so that guy was like, thank God if you got the mid-range. Instead, cedar oil was injected through the anus, which was then plugged shut, and the body was left in salt. So you just got the old squirt.
Cork
in the salt. 70 days later, the plug's removed, the oil comes out, all the dissolved organs squirt out with it, and
really,
quote from Herodotus on that, quote, nothing remains but the skin and bones. So that's the mid tier. You just kind of get the...
And they dump it. They don't put them in jars.
I don't
at
think
that
so.
Point.
Got I don't you. Think so.
Okay. No physical rewards.
The budget tier consisted of an enema with an unnamed liquid.
Okay.
Which I'm thinking maybe...
I'm thinking of the previous liquid. They just took the other guy out of the other guy.
Or this is where the brain juice went.
Ooh, shit.
Is maybe what my thought.
Fuck, dude. You're getting a brain juice cleanse?
So you're getting a up the butt, 70 days in Natron, body returned, no wrapping, no jars,
Natron.
No ceremony, the salt, the Natron
gotcha,
salt.
Gotcha. Jimmy Natron.
Jimmy Natron, boy enema.
there's the pin.
No wrapping, no jars, just sort of a here's your brother. You know, like just boink.
I guess I didn't ask that. The bodies go back to the family.
I believe so, yeah.
So it's like it's a pretty inconvenient.
Well, then you... It's up to you where you put it, I guess.
So
you know?
Then you have to hire an architect to get a fucking pyramid made.
Yeah, if you're a giant rich family. If you're just a regular family, to be honest.
Put it on the mantle like ashes.
Yeah. Well, they always say the
home with a mummy in it is haunted.
No, what's the history of the parlor used to be where the body was placed out?
Oh, yeah.
In the Victorian era. So maybe the Egyptians had their version of the parlor. I mean, at this point,
how big are these houses?
Your loved one is basically a stuffed
Build-A-Bear.
Fox. Yeah. So you can just put it wherever. You sleep with it, just platonically.
Sure. The only thing, it's like, what's that saying? It's like the only, like, whatever is death and taxes.
The only thing is certain in life is death and taxes.
But it's feel like we could make an Egyptian sitcom called Death and Taxidermy.
Hey.
The only thing certain in life is death and taxidermy. And then it's like hard cut, too. It's like, man. That's a lot of mummies in your house.
So that's how you make a human mummy. But humans weren't the only ones getting mummed up. The Egyptians mummified animals too. As I mentioned,
they found
a million cats.
Million cats.
They did this on an absolutely industrial scale. According to history.com.
Remember the Chips Ahoy commercial when we were kids? Like putting on the Ritz or whatever is like playing?
Yeah.
But it's just the... No, putting on the Ritz. It wasn't putting on the Ritz. I don't remember the fuck you just did.
No.
You just did the
That's putting on the Ritz is bump, bump, bump.
No, it's not.
What
you
is
just,
that?
That's fucking Frank Sinatra or something. That's New York, New York.
You're thinking of the
Chips Ahoy commercial. When we were kids.
Yeah, whatever that.
I hope it's royalty free.
Is
that one from the commercial? It has like a fun Glenn Miller orchestra ass song. But either way, it's that, but with cats. It's all I'm getting at.
Yes. And they weren't tap dancing, though. They were just
nobody tap dances in that either. I think they're just making cookies.
I don't think I'm remembering a commercial. This may just be a dream
I had. I think this is a dream you had. Because I think I'll find it. I'll put it in the show notes.
Anyway, some mummified animals were intended as food offerings to humans in the afterlife, so they'd send you off
so
with
jerky.
An ox
in the afterlife. Yeah. Got you. Should have waited for that part.
Many others were created to serve as sacred offerings to the gods, who in ancient Egypt often took animal form, including cats, cows, falcons, frogs, baboons, and vultures, among many others. Animals mummified for this purpose, as a sacred offering, were available for purchase or barter at sacred sites, so kind of like picking up flowers on the way to the grave. You'd swing by, you'd pick up the mummified baboon.
Sure.
You'd go lean it on your loved one's mummy.
Absolutely.
I guess.
Show them you care with a mummified bear or something like that. There was ads and shit chiseled into the side of ziggurat's a different nationality.
Yeah.
Chiseled into the side of
the pyramid.
Which, by the way, have you ever seen the pictures of like the pyramids of Giza from the other angle and it's all just like KFCs and fucking
Chick-fil-A's
and shit? That's a wild image.
Hey, man, human race, we did great.
Yep.
The people who bought these mummified animals, would give them to a priest who would then bury collections of the animals as gifts for the gods.
We grew up with that, right? Like, wasn't like rabbit's feet popular when we were kids? Like having a rabbit's foot, yeah, like a lucky rabbit's foot?
Yeah, that's pretty different, I think. This was sort of...
It's a mummified rabbit foot.
It is, and I guess it was lucky. So
I'm not sure they all were actually rabbit feet, though.
This practice was actually considered more akin to lighting a votive candle at church. You go, you light a candle, and this is sort of, you would go, you bring a...
Well, no wonder it's a factory. Yeah. Because it's like, that seems pretty disposable versus having a rabbit's foot.
This was so widespread in Egypt that animal mummification became big business. Archaeologists have found 30 catacombs in Egypt, with each
one... Is that how they got their name? Catacombs?
I doubt it, but...
Okay, sure.
Quick. That's quick.
That's what I do.
Each one of these was dedicated to a single animal and packed floor to ceiling with mummies for a total that some researchers estimate to be nearly 70 million animal mummies produced over roughly 1,200 years.
That's a booming industry.
And here's the part where we learn that humans have always really been the same, because it turns out a lot of these mummies were a scam.
Oh, I bet.
In the largest study of its kind, researchers at the Manchester Museum and the University of Manchester have used x-rays and CT scans to examine more than 800 ancient Egyptian animal mummies, many of which are now housed or stolen by British museums.
Yeah, dude.
While a third of those mummies contain the well-preserved remains of complete animals, researchers found only partial remains in another third, and in the last third, they found that the mummies were empty of all bones or any animal remains, and the linens were stuffed with items such as mud, sticks, eggshells, and feathers.
Wow. Well, they couldn't use an onion on it. That was too precious.
The Field Museum in Chicago confirmed their most beautifully detailed cat mummy was completely empty inside.
This is a job I'd actually fucking love to have. If I was like on the x-ray team at a museum, every day is the most fun. Because you're like making bets. You're like, is it going to be a fake? Yeah. Is it going to be real? Are we going to find 30 gold coins in it?
Yeah. Was it a piggy bank, but it's a literal pig?
Yeah. Like that to me would be just the coolest job.
I'd also suggest to the Field Museum in Chicago that a great thief may have swapped their real cat mummy with a fake one.
Oh my God. I didn't think about that.
They might want to look into it.
70 million times.
Yeah. Some scientists and archaeologists argue that the ancient customers knew that these mummies didn't contain remains, and the sticks and feathers, this sounds like an old-timey sales pitch, the sticks and feathers were all considered just as important because they had been in close contact with the animals.
Wow. That's after the first guy realized that it's bullshit.
Yeah.
But also, I'd love to see a family member being like, this bullshit fucking, this just sticks. And it was like, Dave, I can't help but notice the mummified thing on the right was $300. And the one you bought was $1.
Yeah.
What did you think was in it?
Yeah.
Like, it was clearly displayed. There was a price difference here.
Yeah. You grabbed the display version and its nose is falling off. And you could see that there is hay in there.
Dude, it's like, you got a great deal on this votive candle, you cheap piece of shit.
But mummies have been around much, much longer than the Egyptian mummies that most of us think of.
Been around almost as long as scams.
Pretty much, yeah. Until the tail end of last year, the oldest mummies we'd ever found were in the Atacama Desert in modern-day Chile and Peru, and we're going to get to those in a minute.
Whoa.
But in September 2025, it was announced that we'd made an even more ancient discovery. According to Smithsonian Magazine...
This is brand new news.
This is brand new news. This literally, no joke, this literally turned what we thought we knew about mummification like upside down at the very end of last year.
Wow.
According to Smithsonian Magazine, quote, researchers examined 54 graves in southern China, the Philippines, Laos, Malaysia, Thailand, and Indonesia. They noticed that many of the bodies that they found in these graves were tucked into tight crouching positions, and that the remains
crouching looked... tiger hidden mummy.
The remains.
I don't even know if that's okay to say.
I think it's fine. Okay. I think it's fine. I'd watch that movie. The remains looked burnt. The 4,000 to 12,000 year old graves didn't contain any evidence that there was ever been a fire within the grave, which indicated the corpses were exposed to heat before being buried.
Okay.
The scientists used non-destructive techniques like X-ray diffraction and infrared spectroscopy to examine the bones. And these tests revealed that the skeleton's discoloration, because they're like jet black, some of them,
yeah,
was caused not by direct combustion, as you would see in like a failed cremation of setting the body on fire, sure, and try to cremate it, but exposure to a low oxygen, smoky environment. And so the research...
So it's like drying meats or drying like foods.
The researchers concluded exactly that many of the bodies were smoke dried. They were arranged in these crouched postures before being propped over or positioned near a fire to slowly dehydrate them. And this process deliberately preserved the remains, which means they were mummified.
Fuck, man.
The reasons that people may have done this are almost as interesting as the process. And this is where we get back to something else you said earlier about how do you carry these guys around before the wheel?
You crouched them up. You put them on sticks like in the cartoons. Those are usually people you're about to eat and put in a cauldron.
Speculated that the people who created these mummies may have been a nomadic tribe of hunter-gatherers who wished to travel with their dead.
Hmm.
So they mummified them so that they could be easily packed in the carry-ons and shuffled off to the next location.
Also, just the idea that what we have is like six guys here, but we don't have our shovels. So yeah, we can throw them on a stick. Let's carry them out. In 100 years, we'll figure out how to bury them.
Yeah. Not every archaeologist agrees that that's what happened, though. One such skeptic, Michael Green, told Smithsonian Mag that, quote, some of the bones the researchers studied had been heated to more than 900 degrees Fahrenheit, indicating something going on the outside of the body that is not going to result in a smoking of the body, but a burning of the body.
I mean, listen, Mike. Fucking
skeptic, buzzkill Mike.
Yeah, you've never gotten a phone call in the middle of making something. Now your risotto stuck to the bottom of the pan. I'm sure every once in a while a fucking panther came to attack the camp and they had to leave the body there a little too long.
His point basically is that whatever was done to these bodies definitely involved fire, but it's possible that the mummification was not the intended purpose, but it was some sort of side effect. And it's tough to know who's right because these are so old.
And people were eating people.
Yes. There could have been some of that, although it's unlikely because these corpses are like black, charred. I think I put a picture
in
the show notes.
We'll never know.
But like, something that lends this theory credence is that this style of mummification is still practiced today by the Anga tribe in Papua New Guinea. I found an article in National Geographic that reported on what they called, quote, the pungent smell of slow-smoked human flesh at the last known modern mummification, that of village elder Gemtasu in 2015.
You think it was one of those things where they found an uncontacted tribe from the smell? And then they're like, we need... And the best part is the guy who proposed going was like, something smells so fucking delicious.
Good, yeah. Like,
over there, we need to see what's going on. And to this day, they're like, oh, something smells delicious, huh? They were burning bodies, guys.
Weirdly enough, Anthony Bourdain discovered these guys on a no reservations trip.
Yeah.
He was like, this smells delicious. No, they described the process. National Geographic describes the process of mummifying Gemtasu like this. Quote, the mummification method follows a strict structure. The body is suspended over a fire, and as it bloats, it is poked with wooden sticks to drain its fluids, and later, a stick is used to gently widen the anus to allow the organs to fall out.
The tree is an amazing thing. Trees are fucking rad.
From start to finish, the mummifiers must remain with the body at all times, and no part of the dead, including his fluids, his intestines, and the body, is allowed to touch the ground, because that is a taboo invitation for bad luck.
So what are they using to catch all the juices?
Unclear. Wasn't described. Okay. I'd assume some sort of bowl or a pot, or maybe the mouth of an unlucky warrior in training, maybe.
Oh no, that guy's not going to survive that.
The finished mummies are then placed up on cliff ledges to sit hundreds of feet above their villages. Chief Moy Mangao, mummified in the 1950s, overlooks one village from over 300 meters up with 22 of his boys at his side.
That's sick.
Unfortunately, the result of this process creates one of the most horrifying mummies I have ever seen in my life.
And also a misunderstanding for anyone who shows up. They're like, they're killing the people and putting them there to scare us away. We're like, no, that's just what we do.
We'll pop this up on screen. But Ed, this is what a smoke-dried mummy in the modern day looks like.
Dude, that's sick. Like that, he's like in a hip hop pose. This could be an album
he's
cover.
He's got the rap squat.
Yeah.
He does, but he looks terrifying. He looks like the cover
of Cannibal Holocaust.
Yeah, or I was going to say
Zombie. Movie
yeah,
Zombie.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how you know I worked in a video store.
You know the cover.
I know
the
cover.
One. It might be like Zombie 3 maybe.
I know
but
exactly
it's one
the cover
them,
that
yeah.
I at first I which is exactly what I was thinking of and I thought Cannibal Holocaust for I'm sure the cover doesn't have that. And the only time I've seen that fucking horrible movie that all copies should be burned is because you showed it to me on Joy Street.
Yep. I've shown that to a few people who have said, why are we watching this?
Dude, that I'm glad people got in trouble for that movie.
So this is one of the scariest mummies I have ever seen. Until,
that one you just showed me?
Yeah.
That genuinely love that guy.
We'll see if you love these guys, because the second scariest mummy I've ever seen is also the second oldest mummy in the world. The Chinchorro mummies of the Atacama Desert. So, Ed, maybe we'll bring these up on screen while we discuss what's happening. You can maybe put them in a little box on the side or something. I'll show you here in person just so you can get a look at...
Love it less.
What we're dealing
with. Love it
with.
Less. And for people to know, it's kind of like if... And this is not probably the actual thing that happened. This mummy looks like if someone cut your face off, mummified it separately, and then placed it back on your head as you deflated below
this
it.
This is another one.
And you know what? I cursed. Think that's exactly what happened, because that's not a fucking face.
Nope, it's not a face.
So it's,
it looks like a face.
It looks like the weird like heads in the wall, Pink Floyd's The Wall.
Yeah.
Gets put on top of you. That's way worse. I don't want that as an album cover. I don't want that as a friend. But the other guys I'd hang out with today.
I will say, though, the story of what's actually happened here is, like, sweet to the point of it's a touching story, despite how terrifying these mummies look.
Yeah, bad hang, though.
The Chinchorro people were mummifying their dead in the deserts of what is now Chile and Peru roughly 2,000 years before Egypt's first mummies, so around 5050 BC.
Okay.
I think we touched on this tribe in another episode.
Oh, my God. That's so many years before B.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wait, no, that is B. It's so much B.
It's
before C.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's crazy. I think it's the most I've ever heard B before C. That doesn't have a dinosaur in it.
I think we touched on this tribe somewhere in another episode, but these were marine hunter-gatherers who developed an extraordinary process for mummification. The bodies were completely defleshed, scalped, disassembled, and then reassembled with sticks and clay, coated in black manganese paste and fitted with clay masks featuring mottled eyes and mouths. It's believed that the goal was to make the dead look alive. Now,
no, they failed.
Some archaeologists have described these as sophisticated, which I would agree with, but also visually appealing, which
I would not agree with.
Maybe to a serial killer.
Yeah, but... if you know what, you don't know what you're going to be into until you see it, I guess, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But my body rejected this one.
There were actually four types of these mummies: black, red, bandaged, and mud coated. So sort of like Egyptian mummies.
We ended up with a bandage. There was tears potentially.
The black mummies were the ones that I just described.
Had the black paste or whatever.
Yeah, the black paste. And they tend to be the oldest examples of these mummies. The red mummies are a little newer, and they were prepared slightly differently. According to an article I found, quote, the body would first be disemboweled, the organs removed through careful incisions. Then the body cavities were filled with different elements, such as soil and feathers. The stitched up body would then be painted with red ochre, while the face was painted with black manganese. Unlike black mummies, red mummies have long black wigs with no mask covering their face.
So
that's the other example we saw. The first one that you commented on would be a red mummy, I believe, with
okay.
the black wig.
Sure. These are a people. We don't have horror films without these people existing. This is the craziest. And I was right that there was like ripping off faces and doing it separately because
yeah.
they reassembled them.
Yeah.
But this is a lot of trial and error, it feels like. And
yeah.
I'm sure huge arguments about like manganese guys being like, manganese is the only way, bro. And
yeah.
it was like, no, red is a vibe. We should do red. And then
yeah.
they probably fought to the death.
I loved red ochre before anybody else ever heard of red ochre.
Well, we're still doing manganese faces. And it's like, oh, black face. That'll age well. And then they fight.
The black and red mummification styles are the most elaborate of the Chinchorro mummies. The other two types, the bandaged and the mud coated, were a little bit less elaborate.
Harder to find manganese and red oak at that point.
The bandage mummies were a variant of the red mummy with the skin being replaced with bandages. So instead of stitching the skin back on, they just said, fuck it, let's wrap it up.
Sure.
The mud-coated mummies were naturally dried bodies that were covered in a thick layer of mud and were the newest Chinchorro mummies that we found, which kind of sounds like they just got lazy. Like they started being artists about this, and then they're like, you know what?
I think it's the same thing we see now. There's a skill gap.
Yeah.
Like, I think some people are like, I'm not going into this, Dad. I'm going to go write TV or whatever. And then hard cut to, it's like, we have no jobs and we don't know how to fix our toilets.
It got enchidified.
So these guys, everyone got white collar jobs in this group and nobody knew anymore how to do it well.
But here's what's sweet about it. Unlike Egypt's hierarchical system where only the rich and the wealthy got the full nice treatment, Chinchorro mummification was radically egalitarian. Men, women, children, and even miscarried fetuses all received the exact same style of care.
Well, whatever style was popular at the time.
Yeah.
Because by the end, they're just getting
thrown in a
wrapped
mud
in
pit.
A leaf. like this is not...
In fact, the earliest and most elaborate mummies that we found were infants and children, which anthropologist
that makes sense.
Bernardo Ariazza suggests was a grief response. High arsenic levels in the Camarones River, where they lived along, caused a lot of miscarriages and stillbirths, and mummification was how parents held on to their lost children.
That's nice. It's the rebirth doll of...
Yeah, of the ancient day.
Of the ancient times. Also,
almost
I can see
more
it as,
horrifying looking than a rebirth
when they put that big black wig on that baby, it's not going to go great. But I do think that's very sweet, and that there is an element of, like, give them the full treatment, because they're without sin. They're just little kids. Yeah. Like, give Boris the shittiest wig.
Yeah.
Because he was kind of a dick when he was alive. You know what I mean? Let's not waste any time on Boris, but, like, these kids did nothing wrong.
No. They had to dress him up. So it certainly seems like no matter what culture you were part of, mummification was a sacred, somber ritual that held great emotional and religious meaning. So, of course, when the Europeans got their hands on mummies, they immediately desecrated them for health and pleasure. For roughly 500 years, from the 12th through the 18th century, Europeans consumed ground-up Egyptian mummies as medicine. And this,
I'm sorry, what?
This all started...
That sounds like the going to kill you. Whatever, don't put that in your body.
Yeah, this all started with a mistranslation. So get this. The Arabic word mumia originally was the word for bitumen, which is a greasy black petroleum-like product, which according to a Substack I found written about this whole debacle, the bitumen or mumia,
it's oil.
It did have legitimate uses like waterproofing ships and treating wounds. But when European translators,
like whale blubber.
Yeah, when European translators encountered the word, they confused it with the similar looking resin that coated Egyptian mummies. So one Italian translator, Gerard of Cremona, the wrongest man of all time, declared that mumia was created when, quote, the liquid of the dead mixed with the aloes is transformed. Another scholar insisted that it formed when spices used in mummification mixed with bodily fluids.
Body, these two fucking homunculus ass
so
clowns.
There's two giant leaps of logic happening here.
Yeah.
The first is that the stuff that was... The stuff on mummies looked like bitumen, which was used to do actual things.
Which, so, by the way, neither of these were for health benefits.
Correct. So, like, they jumped from, they said, this looks like this other thing that didn't really have any health benefits.
Yeah.
But it was useful.
I've been giving my kids insulation instead of cotton candy exactly. for years, and it's fine.
And they're doing great.
They're doing great.
The two leaps were, this stuff on mummies looks like this other stuff that's useful. Then there was a leap of, well, this other stuff that's useful might have health properties, which then turned into, oh, the stuff on mummies cures things, which then just jumped straight to crushed up mummies cure things.
It's amazing. And I don't know if it's like a European exclusive thing. It doesn't sound like it based on the fake cats. But it seems like we can't go three episodes without a snake oil salesman.
No.
Like just everything is... Everything is like, you want to be young forever? You want to be beautiful?
Snort mummy powder.
Yeah, eat mummy powder. Do this.
Within a few generations.
Look, mummies look young forever. So put it on your face.
I mean, I'm sure that was the logic to a certain point. It was like, look, they're...
Yeah, they if we do great. It while we're alive, we'll be double young.
Within a few generations, every well-stocked European apothecary was selling powdered mummy. Ugh. The 1618 London pharma...
And you know only like 1/18 of those were powdered mummy.
Yes.
The rest were just like cobblestone street dust.
1,000%.
Yeah.
The 1618 London Pharmacopoeia, the official catalog of approved medicines in England, listed mummy alongside essential remedies and described the taste as, quote, somewhat acrid and bitterish because you're eating a ground up dead person.
Yeah. Side effects may include death immediately.
It was prescribed, ground up mummy was prescribed for headaches, epilepsy, plague, bruising, paralysis, nosebleeds, and childbirth. King Francis I of France carried a personal pouch of powdered mummy mixed with rhubarb everywhere he went.
Something tells me there was a King Francis II real quick after
King
that.
King Charles II of England rubbed mummy on his skin to, quote, absorb the greatness of pharaohs, and even had a signature cocktail called the King's Drops, which was powdered human skull dissolved in alcohol.
It's a power you can't buy.
Robert Boyle, widely considered the father of modern chemistry.
Because he was the first one who came up with the idea to boil this first to get rid of all the fucked up impurities.
He called mummy.
You might survive one day longer.
He called mummy, quote, one of the most useful medicines.
Yeah, but that sounds like a 4 out of 5 doctors agree. Like he was paid
yeah,
to say that.
This is how, this tells you how bad medicine was in the 1600s. They were like, powdered mummy is one of the best options we've got. And you know it wasn't doing jack shit for anybody.
It tells me two things. One, the overwhelming disrespect of Europeans to the culture of the place they took it from.
Mm-hmm.
Just crazy disrespect. But I'm sure it was originally called like savage skincare or something. Or like barbarian beauty.
Yeah.
But the second thing it tells me is the most shocking episode we've done is maybe waking up during surgery where we find out kind of how recent, genuinely good medicine and techniques
yeah.
are. And I find that's the first thing I thought of when you told me that they pelted a man who made an incision.
Yeah.
Like, just to tell you what hurdles we have to get to modern surgery
yep.
that we have to overcome. And so, yeah, between what I will refer to from here on out as get out of here science.
Yeah.
So between get out of here science.
Is that like an I fucking love science, but it's the bad version?
It's a, you beat it. You scram right. science. We'll deal with you. We're putting this down the, kicking science down the road.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So between get out of here science and the seemingly universal siren's call of scammery.
Yep.
Like, it's amazing that we're living in a time period that we got to see at least a few years of like genuine benefits in both society and health.
Yeah.
Most other places than here at the moment. But I'm saying, like, what a weird little pocket we got to experience.
Well, that is a great segue into the next part of this story of mummy medicine, because much like those mummified animal corpses we talked about earlier, scammers quickly took over the medicinal mummy trade.
Not a surprise.
Quote, entrepreneurs got creative. Some merchants discovered it was easier to manufacture fresh mummies than dig up old ones.
Stop it. You mean really make mummies out of people?
They purchased corpses of executed criminals, plague victims, and enslaved people, dried them out, coated them in resin, and passed them off as ancient Egyptian royalty.
I feel like purchase was in air quotes.
In 1564, French physician Guy de la Fontaine witnessed the process firsthand in Alexandria, watching merchants prepare fresh corpses for export. One dealer confessed they could produce 40 ancient mummies in a single batch.
Also, we saw them preparing bodies for export. It was like, no, this was going to the cemetery. Like, where yeah. this wasn't shipping abroad.
Oh, no. Now they're going all over the world. But even crazier, I think, is the practice of medicinal mummies lasted until at least 1908, because we have a commercial listing for medicinal mummy in the Merck catalog of 1908. So Merck Pharmaceuticals.
Merck is what?
Merck still exists. They're still a pharmaceutical company.
In America?
In America. Well, they're probably owned by like a
sure,
German.
Sure, yeah. But I'm saying they were an American company though at the time?
I believe Merck was American.
Okay.
They were a big they're an early pharmaceutical company.
Sure.
And in their 1908 catalog, they were still selling medicinal mummy under the heading, quote, genuine Egyptian mummy as long as the supply lasts. 17 marks, 50 per kilogram.
What the fuck's a mark?
Oh, is maybe there, a Dutch mark. So maybe they're a Dutch
European
company.
Yeah, there's no way we were, because America's 8 days old.
Sure. It's not like they didn't have doctors in Germany or
let's not bring up German doctors for any reason on this show.
Or Danish doctors or whatever. Like, there was science, there was knowledge in 1908.
Yeah. Oh, 1908, for sure.
That's when this
we
was.
We had automobiles.
This was 1908. They were still selling genuine
Egyptian
giant
mummy.
Giant air quotes around genuine.
Yeah.
Great way to dispose of a body, though, if you were murdering people back then. Grind them up in a mummy paste and...
I will say there was probably a lot more money to be made having corpses on hand than not having corpses on
hand.
I'd
also love to know, once you were purchasing powdered mummy, mm-hmm. do you require or would you want to require some sort of proof of lineage that ties it to a mummy? Because if you're just buying powdered mummy...
I think it should require it, but I think even lobbying at the time... was like, we don't have to actually.
It would be cute, though, if the pharmacist wrapped the bottle in a little bit of the mummy bandage. You know?
They probably did it and still wasn't real. Yeah. All these little gimmicks.
Anyway.
I can see this shit in the manosphere right now. Like Andrew Tate being like, you need to take mummy supplements.
We are a week away from that. Get
your jaw strong and take these mummy supplements.
By the Victorian era, mummies had been ground up and used in everything from medicine to fertilizer to even paint. But the Victorians' relationships...
Isn't this like how Crisco was made? It was like industrial runoff, and now it's like the best way to make a pie.
Yeah.
I'm half joking. I think a lot of that is true.
The Victorian relationship with mummies went way beyond paint and medicine. They also hosted mummy unwrapping parties.
We talked about this in Curses.
We mentioned this in Curses, but we're going a lot deeper into it.
Hate to hear it. Okay.
According to the website Burial and Beyond, quote, it's generally believed...
Where's the bed in that? They feel like they fucked up.
It's generally believed that the first unwrapping public event was conducted by archaeologists, a term we're using very loosely here, Giovanni Bolzoni, who in 1821 unwrapped a cadaver in Piccadilly Circus to a reported audience of thousands. Now, Giovanni was known as the Great Belzoni.
Okay.
He was a prominent Italian explorer with a taste for showmanship,
and
obviously.
He was a prominent Italian magician. Like, aided, nobody has a name like that.
Aided. This guy was like the rock of his
also
time.
Also aided. Magicians have AIDS.
No, this guy's
a magician.
Let me finish my sentence. This guy was the rock of his time. He was an explorer with a taste for showmanship and aided by his former career as a circus strongman.
Okay.
So he started in entertainment and became an archaeologist. He kicked off the era of mummy desecration with his own discoveries in Egypt, most notably his unearthing of the mummy at Psamethis. And another source tells us that while he did, in fact, make many dramatic discoveries, Belzoni was also infamous for using a battering ram to open tombs and for carving his name in the Temple of Abu Simbel.
Well, here's the thing.
this guy was not American, but you'd be forgiven for thinking that he was.
Yeah. Geez Louise, though, because there is an element of, there's no element of anything. This guy's just kind of shitty.
In any case, his event was marketed towards medical professionals, but Belzoni came out wrapped in bandages, which
makes me think
he knew exactly what he was doing.
Yeah.
It's like how in the early days of exploitation films, they would, you know, you see a sex movie, but it would be like the dangers of childbirth or whatever. And the first 20 minutes would be basically pornography. And then but it was educational. So it was safe.
Yeah.
I think that's what this guy was doing here.
It's crazy to come out in bandages.
I know.
That's the circus in him he couldn't get rid of.
His assistant for this show was
like magicians.
Yeah, like a magician. But his assistant here was a prominent doctor named Thomas Pettigrew.
Who apologized at every event for being involved in this.
Oh, no. He was famous for having vaccinated Queen Victoria, I guess, in the early days of vaccinations, and was friends with Charles Dickens. So he was a real man about town. And he also... quickly stole Belzoni's whole act and became London's premier mummy showman.
I feel like that also happens in magicians.
This earned him the name of Mummy Pettigrew. In his January 1834 unwrapping at the Royal College of Surgeons sold out, with people turned away at the door and other mummy unwrapping events attracting up to 3,000 spectators.
I mean, it is a cool event.
Once the trend caught on, because it is a cool event, the rich jumped right on board, and according to Haunted Palace blog, quote, many wealthy individuals were said to have obtained their own mummies and invited their friends over to soirees to dine, drink, and dissect. As these upper-class parties often involved copious amounts of alcohol, they could end up quite raucous.
Who's that guy who had the mummy fucking martini earlier or whatever? He'd be doing well now. Oh, someone who had his own, like, cocktail, you said.
The King Charles had a skull drop.
Yeah, I'm sure that made a comeback at these parties.
Often, artifacts, wrappings, and even body parts would get tossed around amongst the curious guests. Such parties were almost always purely for the entertainment of the upper class, and little regard was paid either to respect for the dead or preserving archaeological artifacts, which makes me think mummy curses are bullshit, because if anyone was going to get cursed, it would be these people who are tearing mummies limb from limb at a drunken party in some castle.
Not one person has been indicted. And all the new stuff coming out in the news these days, you make a certain amount of money, it sounds like, you can do with any body part at any age you want. I don't know if mummy curses are real. We do introduce many characters who deserve to be cursed so far.
Yes.
I think is what the point you're making, but
it never seemed to have come bit anybody in the ass.
It doesn't seem like anybody's getting in trouble for anything here.
Although, Victorian era, even if you were rich, the chances that you were going to eventually meet some sort of a protracted and painful death are pretty good. So, you know, whether you were being hung in the town square by angry peasants or being carved inside out or just getting some horrible disease.
Sure.
You were probably, even the wealthy, there was a level of...
like, let's throw the bodies around now before dysentery comes or whatever.
So this also continued until 1908.
What happened in 1908?
I don't know.
We hadn't started World War I yet.
But that was... 1908 was
the
last...
there wasn't the great mummy curse cleansing.
Maybe the mummy curse was World War I. It just took a while to build up across Europe. All the angry mummies. You know, we got to check and see what was Ferdinand up to right before he got plugged? Was he dancing with the leg of a ancient prince?
He might very well have been. He had the money. They come from a family, I think.
So, yeah. Could have
thrown these parties.
The last public unwrapping was performed in 1908 by, let's hear it, for the first woman appointed as a lecturer of archaeology in the UK, Margaret Murray.
Welcome, Peggy.
She was the last known public unwrapper, and maybe she put an end to it. Maybe she said, we've had enough.
Or people were like, women are doing it now?
Not this is cool anymore.
Not cool anymore, man.
Anyway, I want to end this episode with the story of a modern mummy. A story that is equal parts funny and sad and fills me with a little bit of mummy ennui. There's something eerie and beautiful about this
mummy. It's not that mummy that they made the voice box work, the dumbest thing in the world?
No.
Okay.
This is the story of Elmer McCurdy, the wandering mummy. In life, Elmer McCurdy was a scoundrel.
Yeah, he was always chasing Bugs Bunny.
According to History.com, he was, quote, born in 1880 in Washington, Maine. So confusion from a young age
Yeah.
And raised by his aunt and uncle.
He had 28 years where he could have seen a mummy unwrapping.
That's true, yeah. But he never did because he was poor. And he learned by the time he was a teenager, he learned that his aunt and uncle weren't his actual parents.
Oh, no.
So he thought that his aunt and uncle were his real parents until he was a teenager. Which
when he realized he was been abducted.
History.com notes possibly contributed to a life of discontent. For a time, McCurdy lived with his grandfather, apprenticed as a plumber, and did manage to reconnect with his mother.
He had a good life.
But in 1898, he lost his job in an economic crash, and in 1900, his mother and grandfather both passed away. So McCurdy headed west, drifting through Kansas and Missouri.
I thought this story was going to be like, they passed away and he found himself the inheritant of two fresh bodies.
And went mummy mode.
Yeah, dude.
No, he became a drifter, and in 1907, he joined the U.S. Army, learning explosive skills crucial to his later crimes.
Dude, he...
not to tip my hand about where this is going, but...
yeah, but he really could have fucked up. He could have joined the Army in the mummification department and would only have 1 year before those skills became unnecessary.
True. He was honorably discharged in 1910 and quickly returned to a life of dishonor. Only weeks after leaving the military, authorities arrested McCurdy and another soldier for possession of burglary paraphernalia, including nitroglycerin.
That's burglary? That's like making TNT paraphernalia.
McCurdy and his compatriot convinced a jury they were just building a foot-powered machine gun. No additional details on that.
Fair.
McCurdy then traveled to Oklahoma, where he joined a gang of small-time outlaws known as Yeggs. Y-E-G-S.
Okay.
Which sounds like a real slur, but it's just sort of a term for these layabout gangsters, sort of.
Okay.
The Pinkerton Detective Agency published a pamphlet in 1904 about a group known as Yeggs, says Michael Williams, site director of the Oklahoma Territorial Museum and Carnegie Library. They were an element that grew out of the hobo community.
Sure.
While most hobos traveled to find work, Yeggs traveled to commit crimes.
There was like a hobo language, though, right?
I think there was some crossover between the hobo community and the Yegg community.
And if I've seen any hobo language, it's pretty close to hieroglyphics.
Yes.
So we've come full circle.
On October 4th, 1911, McCurdy and his Yeggs robbed the wrong train. They made off with only $46 and a jug of whiskey instead of the $400,000 $400,000 they thought they were going to rob off this train.
How many bindles did they bring to carry that out?
Maybe that's how they got caught. They left the bindles on the train. Yeah. But
for people listening at home who aren't comedy writers, bindles is the stick with the handkerchief attached to it that you carry things in.
Robbing a train was not taken lightly, and a reward was issued for McCurdy, $2,000, dead or alive. And in the early hours of October 7th, 1911, just a few days later, law enforcement surrounded a barn near Bartlesville, Oklahoma, where McCurdy had taken shelter. He refused to surrender and opened fire on the officers. Not a great time in American history to be opening fire on kind of law officers.
Never a good time in American history to do that, but this is a Yegg's last stand, dude.
Quote, "He took a shot at me first," Officer Bob Fenton told the Blackwell Weekly Sun.
Not quoted as him turning to all the other cops going, right?
Yeah.
Right, guys?
Then he took a shot at Officer Stringer Fenton, who's probably nodding and going, yeah,
he did.
And after that, he took three shots at Officer Richard Wallace before we opened up. The gunfight lasted more than an hour.
Yeah, guns are not accurate.
But when the shooting stopped,
would have been a lot faster if he had a foot-powered machine gun.
What the fuck happened to that?
Yeah, he couldn't get it together.
I hope they at least filed a patent. That could have been a real, like, he could have gone legit.
He could have gone legit. They were stealing the money for no investors. They had no investors.
I've never seen this, I don't think, but I imagine him basically like sitting in a bike seat, you know, with his legs up and like, that must have been what they were building. Yeah. I don't know if those ever existed or if that's just in my imagination.
I don't know. I mean, you just did some sort of like egg beater boat thing with your feet, so I don't know.
Yeah, but you know, like pull a Gatling gun that you power with your feet.
Yes, that's a great idea and not at all what I thought it was. I thought it was some sort of like a pedal, like a sewing
needle pedal. Oh, so you're just sitting like
pedal.
Bop, 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 bop.
I didn't even think it was powered like with your leg. I thought it was like how they open a trap in Ghostbusters. He just like presses it once. But yeah, you were thinking about the mechanics of
it. Yeah. Anyway, when the shooting stopped, these guys found McCurdy dead in the hayloft. And it's here, in this remote hayloft in the middle of nowhere of Oklahoma, that the light leaves Elmer McCurdy's eyes and his story really begins. His body was taken to the Johnson Funeral Home in Pawhuska, Oklahoma, where it was embalmed and preserved with a heavy dose of arsenic.
Do you think it's hard to embalm a body if it's filled with bullet holes? Like, do you have to patch all that so shit doesn't just pour out?
I think actually they did patch. Well, yes, I think they patched these bullet holes.
Okay.
With his mom dead and his actual father long gone and his aunt and uncle, I guess, none too enthusiastic about picking up their body of this damn Yegg.
Yeah.
Elmer's corpse, mummified with chemicals, sat in the mortuary unclaimed for 6 months.
So this is an accidental mummification.
Well, he was mummified to be buried. Like, his body was preserved because they didn't know what else to do with it. And I guess they weren't just going to throw it out and no one came to claim
it. Times have changed. Could have sold it to a rich party.
Locals took notice of Elmer's body sitting in the mortuary, and he became an attraction worth paying for.
Wait, why did locals see it at all?
I think
is it in the window?
I think they put him out front. Yeah, I think at some point they put him out front, and then we know, quote, the undertaker dressed McCurdy in street clothes, gave him a rifle and charged visitors 5 cents to see the embalmed bandit collecting the coins through the parted lips of the lifeless
Stop
outlaw.
Stop it. That is somehow more disrespectful than using the door-busting thing on... No, it's not, actually.
On
Fuck
graves?
It.
No, but it's close. It's not remember that detail, the coin slot. In 1916, two men posing...
Oh, Jimmy Findick showed up to use the coin slot.
In 1916, two men posing as McCurdy's brothers convinced the funeral home to release the body to them. They were not McCurdy's brothers. They were actually James and Charles Patterson, carnival promoters, who proceeded to add McCurdy to the Patterson Traveling Slideshow as, quote, the outlaw who would never be captured alive, and he became a grim centerpiece in a lineup of human curiosities.
Do we need to outlaw circuses? I'm sorry, but there are too many main characters in these come from that background.
It gets crazier. McCurdy's body then changed hands repeatedly. For more than half a century, the McCurdy mummy... bounced from crime exhibits to drug awareness campaigns to haunted houses and low-budget films. In 1922, the body had passed to Louis Sonny, a former cop turned showman who ran a traveling museum of crime featuring wax outlaws.
And this real man.
Yeah, McCurdy was the only exhibit that was real, and Sonny toured him up and down the West Coast for decades. In 1928, McCurdy traveled with the sideshow for the Trans-American Foot Race, a cross-country race that I guess he brought all these bodies with him. When it passed through Oklahoma, Sonny's son, okay. Louis Sonny's son, sure. Edward, refused to display the body for fear someone might recognize it. Because again,
this is where it's from.
Yeah, and this is only 25 years after he was killed. Not even. This is 1928 and he was killed in 1911.
Yeah, and the last time you were in Oklahoma, you were like, where are his brothers? We're going to give him a proper burial.
Well, those
not harness his ghost soul.
That was like three owners back. But okay. Edward was smart and was like, we can't just put this guy out on the side of the road. Someone might know him. So Bob Fenton, the deputy who had helped kill McCurdy 17 years earlier, requested a private viewing. He looked at the body, said nothing, and walked away.
Weird.
Weird. Maybe he had some unfinished business. I don't know. But he somehow knew the body was in town and wanted some alone time with it.
I don't know why, but this story in particular is the first time I felt that the soul is trapped in this mummy and that his unfinished business might be like a business deal at this point.
In 1933, exploitation filmmaker Dwayne Esper borrowed the corpse and stood it in theater lobbies during screenings of his drug scare film Narcotic with an exclamation point, rebranding McCurdy as a dead dope fiend who'd killed himself or gotten himself killed during a drugstore robbery.
Wow.
We used to be a film industry, man. Yeah. We used to be able to really make some money. After Louis Sonny died in 1949, his other son, Dan, shoved the body into a warehouse in L.A. for 15 years.
Stop it. What year was this?
1949 to 1964, Elmer McCurdy's body sat, Raiders of the Lost Ark style.
I mean, we won the war. People were getting free houses. Maybe we don't need the gimmick anymore.
In 1964, the body was lent to another exploitation producer,
David, back at war.
David F. Friedman. And
no more McCurdy, free houses.
McCurdy makes what is described as a blink and you'll miss it appearance in the 1967 film She Freak, filmed at the Kern County Fair in Bakersfield, California.
Wow.
In 1968, Dan sold McCurdy and a bunch of wax figures for $10,000 to Spoonie Singh, founder of the Hollywood Wax Museum.
Oh.
Spoonie deemed McCurdy too gruesome to display. So two Canadian operators...
Well, he's only been lightly used for 40 years or whatever.
Two Canadian operators then took the body of McCurdy to display at a show near Mount Rushmore where a windstorm blew off the tips of his ears, fingers, and toes.
Oh.
By 1971, the damaged corpse ended up at the Pike Amusement Zone in Long Beach, mounted to a coffin with a mechanical rig that made him twitch as the cars passed by in the dark.
Wait, our Long Beach?
Our Long Beach. When one operator drilled a mounting hole in McCurdy's foot, quote, some yellow gooey stuff came out on the drill.
I feel bad for this.
This guy didn't know that this was a real corpse. He was just told, put this,
he thought it was
body. Yeah.
Yeah.
Finally, around 1972, the operators of the Amusement Zone defaulted on their lease. Sounds like circus people.
Yeah.
McCurdy was confiscated, spent a year in an electrician's closet, got painted with Day-Glow fluorescent orange paint, and was hung from a noose inside the Laugh in the Dark funhouse, where he dangled by his neck for 4 years.
I am losing my mind with this story.
By this point, no living person on Earth knew that the glowing figure
was real.
From this noose was real. Everyone just assumed it's a paper
not
machine.
Only real, it's in hell. It's in ag. The soul of this man, who I don't know if he was a bad enough criminal, honestly, deserve this.
December 8th, 1976, 65 years after McCurdy is gunned down in Oklahoma, a crew from Universal Studios filming the episode Carnival of Spies, episode 19, season 4 of The $6 Million Man.
Okay.
Is filming inside the Laugh in the Dark ride where this body is hanging. Crew member Chris Haynes noticed the neon reddish-orange figure swinging from a noose in the background of a shot. Didn't want to have a repeat of the Wizard of Oz background hanging.
Yeah.
And tried to move it. When he grabbed the arm, it snapped off in his hands, revealing human bone and desiccated muscle tissue beneath the layers of wax and paint.
Holy shit.
Homicide detectives were called, and the body was removed on a stretcher.
Good luck solving this one.
Beneath a white sheet. Here's how they solved it.
Because of the bill of sales. It's moved hands so many
Even
times.
Even better. An autopsy revealed his gunshot wounds. So they went, okay, this guy got plugged. We know he was killed by guns. When they opened his mouth, they found a corroded 1924 penny.
Oh, because they used to put the money.
Ticket stubs in his throat. One reading Louis Sonny's Museum of Crime, 524 South Main Street, Los Angeles.
Holy shit.
So they were able to track him back to Louis Sonny, and they said, who the fuck is this guy?
That coin's probably worth more now than that entire, like, all of his sales combined.
And here is sort of the kind of sweet, touching cherry on top of this whole thing. On April 22nd, 1977.
Scare All the Time purchased him for $11,
and
guys.
And here he is.
He's in the studio.
He drops from the ceiling on a noose. On April 22nd, 1977, a horse-drawn hearse brought Elmer McCurdy to the Boot Hill section of Summit View Cemetery in Guthrie, Oklahoma, where he was buried alongside fellow bandit Bill Doolin and his Wild Bunch gang. 300 people attended the service, and to prevent any further exploitation, 2 feet of concrete was allegedly poured over his casket. But the thing that kind of gets me, not the most patriotic guy in the world, but on Veterans Day and Memorial Day, Elmer McCurdy gets a flag placed on his grave just like any other veteran.
Yeah, he was a vet. Wow.
So that is
a vet of the horror wars.
Yeah, a vet of the skeleton army, the mummy marines.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. That story is unbelievable.
And I apologize to anybody. I think we briefly may have mentioned some part of this story. I could not find in our notes where.
You're probably thinking of the guy with the sunglasses, the monk with the sunglasses.
There's maybe, but there's somewhere I think we may have mentioned Elmer McCurdy, but we certainly did not tell his whole story. I didn't remember most of this, but the $1 million man thing, I was like, wait a second, did we do this?
This story, the thing I love about this story is it's unbelievable and interesting, and also doesn't make for a movie or anything. So it's not even like, it's just interesting to learn about.
It is, but here's the thing. I kind of think Terrence Malick or like somebody could do, remember, what's his name made that movie, A Ghost Story?
Yeah, but we don't need that.
I mean,
this,
I didn't really love that
so,
movie. But
yeah, there you go.
This is sort of the trauma version of A Ghost Story.
Yeah, I don't want a trauma
shitting,
story.
He's like leaking, he's hanging.
To me, it's in the same way that I feel, like I can't watch RoboCop. I just feel too bad for RoboCop that this is his life.
Yeah,
and it's kind of against his will, and also after a shooting.
Yeah,
I just feel so like inherently bad for this. At least he was buried in the Boot Hill grave. Isn't that where you usually put criminals.
Well, the Boot Hill Cemetery, I think, is a famous cemetery because of the amount of gangsters buried there. I forget. Or I guess, well, no, you might be right. He's buried in the Boot Hill section of Summit View. So I guess maybe that's the,
Because I only know it from that fairly fictitious Billy Joel song about Billy the Kid.
Mm-hmm.
And because there's no, I don't know, knows, I think, where his, what his real name was and where he's buried. Right. But he has, like, he mentions, like, the Boot Hill grave that bears his name.
Yeah.
And it's the only time, until this story, I've ever heard the term Boot Hill before.
Well,
but
if you're ever driving back through the middle of the country, you can maybe stop and visit.
I definitely can.
Albert McCurdy.
I definitely can.
Check him out.
I've gone through Oklahoma a bunch of times.
So that brings us to the fear tier. Ed, where would you place mummies on your fear tier?
Considerably lower than whatever Elmer had done after, like, you were saying being mummified or being attacked by a mummy.
Because
we didn't get into many, like, mummy curse things.
I place mummies at a one on my fear tier.
It's a one.
I'm not afraid of them in the movies. I'm not afraid of them in real life. I am terrified of what's happened to Elmer Guthrie happening to me.
Exactly, dude. Although, interesting that he had a... You know, he lived on in many ways.
Yeah.
Just the worst possible way to live on.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a one.
If his Ka and Ba were trapped hanging on by a thread.
Dude,
they were hanging
on
by a thread.
I would say a one to go all the way back to what I said early in this episode, which is, and mummies. Mummies are an afterthought. Mummies are a thing that's also here.
Yep.
But tough go of it. If anything, I'm like an 8 on not being left alone after I die is like a high for me now, where it's like either given some medicine or like turn into a fucking Dayglow, a park attraction, or having the wealthy throw me around at parties. So like, like being mummified and the torturous existence thereafter, I'm actually very on board with mummy curses. I think it's warranted.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a fucking one.
Yeah, it's a one for me too. So that's the end of the episode. If you've made it this far, you probably love the show. So don't forget to go to patreon.com/scaredallthetime. Sign up for one of our 3 mummification levels. You'll see them there on the site. We've got all kinds of good bonuses. Unfortunately, neither of us are equipped to put pine oil in your butt.
Can't
but
afford it.
Pretty much everything else is available on the on the Patreon. So head over there, join us for some live shows. Leave us a 5-star review, like, subscribe, follow wherever you're listening to this. Don't miss an episode of Scared All the Time. Mm-hmm. And until next time, I'm Chris Kalari.
And I'm Ed Ficola.
The show is Scared All the Time, and we will see you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Scared All the Time is co-produced by Chris Kalari and Ed Ficola.
Written by Chris Kalari.
Edited by Ed Ficola.
Additional support and keeper of sanity is Tess Feifel.
Our theme song is the track Scared by Perpetual Stew.
And Mr. Disclaimer is...
And just a reminder, you can now support the podcast on Patreon and get all kinds of cool shit in return. Depending on the tier you choose, we'll be offering everything from ad-free episodes, producer credits, exclusive access, and exclusive merch.
So go sign up for our Patreon at scaredallthetimepodcast.com.
Don't worry, all scaredy cats welcome.
No part of the show can be reproduced anywhere without permission. Copyright Astonishing Legends Production.
Night.
We are in this together.
Together.
Together.